This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, I come from love. Nikki Finney has been sheltering in place in her home state of South Carolina, where she lives with her wife, Tonya. I called her up to talk about her latest collection, titled Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry, Poems and Artifacts.
Helena?
Yes. How is this? Can you hear me okay?
This is good. Yeah, very well.
She told me she was sitting in a quiet spot, her little studio in the backyard of their home in Columbia.
It's an old neighborhood. It's one of the oldest neighborhoods in town, and it used to be a swamp. And we still have owls and all kinds of creatures that romp and roam. And I have magnolia trees and live oak trees in my backyard. We are in a subtropics, so we still have a winter. But my spinach and squash and collards have been growing since I went into quarantine until the second week of March. I planted stuff. I said, this is crazy. My grandmother would say, have you lost your mind? You're not supposed to plant anything until April, you know, at least.
She grew up in Sumter, only an hour's drive from where she lives now. And reading her collection, Love Child, I felt like I was walking through her childhood home. There's a picture of Nikki as a little girl watering the garden with a hose. There are many sweet notes and letters from her father, Ernest Finney Jr., a famous civil rights lawyer who died while Nikki was working on the book. There's a piece of fabric with a geometric print. There are newspaper clippings of reviews for her first book. There's an African mask and etchings and drawings. So when I asked her about her new book, Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry, Poems and Artifacts, I asked first about those artifacts that make this book feel like a home. Your book is so suffused with home and a feeling of belonging, you know. And of course, even though I don't know you and I haven't grown up in your neighborhood, you know, it's funny that really gave me such a strong sense of rootedness.
Wow. That is so amazing, Helena, because I mean, I have boxes and boxes of letters and ephemera like that, and I've kept that since I was a child. And I'm not quite sure why. I think as I got older, I would read stories about Black women writers or poets, and it was always there was this sadness involved where they had not saved their papers or they had not saved the path, the map of how they got from being 15 to being 25 to being first book. And then, you know, I remember the story of Zora Neale Hurston. Somebody didn't know she was who she was because she was working, you know, cleaning houses in Florida, and they took all of her things and put it in a oil can and just set it on fire. And I was like, I'm going to keep my things. I'm going to keep every flyer, everything. And then I'm going to tell somebody, in that room right there is the map of my life.
Yeah.
Don't throw that out. Look at it first. And so this was my attempt while I am alive to bring just a little light to the path of what has made me humanly who I am, but also pointed a light on the literary map and the girl who was such a devoted reader and her mother who helped make her that by reading to her as a child. I mean, what you're talking about in terms of home and the things that make us who we are, we have returned to that because everything else is shaking like a leaf on a tree.
Yeah.
We don't have anything else but those things that we know that are in our bones. You know, when my father got to the end of his life, he could remember nothing from yesterday, nothing. But he could remember everything from the beginning of his life when he was a boy and his favorite food and his favorite aunt and his favorite cow. You know, it's like all these memories kept flooding back. Because these are the things that when people try to, you know, change you and try to cut you down and try to criticize you, you go back to the things that people who loved you poured into you. That's all we have.
I know that you spent, I think, 23 years in Kentucky.
Yeah, 23 years. I left in 2013, yeah.
Right. And then you went back home to South Carolina, where you're from, to be with your dad. Can you tell me what prompted that move? And
sure.
Can you describe a little bit how you spent that time with him?
Yes. My father and I were hand in hand my entire childhood. And even when we were fighting and I was an adolescent, he was trying to tell me right and wrong. I was still... Everybody knew our connection. He would come and get me when I was a girl, and he would take me on these drives, and he would go about 25 miles per hour, and he would, my place in his big Buick Electra car back in the day was in the back window, and I would lie flat in the back window, and he would drive through this park, through these 100-year-old trees and all these birds nesting, and all these, you know, magnolia blossoms. And he would say, "Love child, what do you see?" I'd say, "Oh, I see, Daddy, there's a magnolia that's as big as a spaceship." Or I would say, there's a bird perched on the top of the tree and a limb is swaying like a flag. You know, and he would go, "What else do you see?" And he would just like, let me talk in this language that, you know, somebody else in my family might correct. You know how you start correcting children at an early age so that they don't sound as crazy and wonderful and lovely as they are, because you want them to be accepted and not stared at. And I felt like my father saw me. His name for me, Love Child, the name of the book is the name he called me privately, you know, with his name for me. And he thought, I realized later in my life, if I give you this name now, then when other people tell you who you are in the world, you won't believe them, because you'll know you're a love child. You will know you were loved. You will know that nobody else can put a name on you that does not fit.
Oh, wow.
So in 2013, we realized, I knew for about a year he was having trouble with memory. We finally had the diagnosis, and he was in the first stages of Alzheimer's. And my mom called me and she said, you know, he always said he did not want to be institutionalized. If he could stay at home, he said, that's what I want to do. And I was like, Mom, I'm coming home. I'm coming to take care of Daddy. I'm coming to help you take care of Daddy, because she had already said, I'm going to take care of him best I can. And so I moved home in September of 2013. And this was the best part. I had five years with him as an adult, you know, not as an adolescent, not as a child in the back window of the car, but as a person pushing the wheelchair into the park. We would go to the mall, and he loves cheeseburgers, and we would get a cheeseburger, and we would just sit there, and he would just like stare at people and eat, and then say, why did you bring me here? You know, like, you know, it's just, he'd forget.
Yeah.
I have these pictures of him. I have video of him. I have images of him singing. And I kept thinking he was going to become mean and, you know, disgruntled. And like so many Alzheimer's patients sometimes do, because they're lost. Your brain is basically shriveling.
Right.
And he never did. He just stayed this sweet, just teddy bear up until the end of his life.
Yeah.
And we were there when he passed. And it was just a very special time. And I really didn't have Daddy's letters in the manuscript. The manuscript was in process, but I didn't have the letters until he passed. And I thought, this is the part that's missing, his actual voice in the book. Mm-hmm. It was always named Love Child, and it was always a map of how I came to be. I didn't know that the art director at Northwestern was going to actually use Daddy's actual handwriting for the cover of the book.
Oh, it was not your choice.
Yes. Yes. Huh. It was not my choice. It was. And so when she showed it to me, I just started weeping. I was just crying because I knew his handwriting so well. He had this beautiful handwriting. And so she imposed his header to me on a letter right in the center of the book. And that was it. It was just like perfection.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Because it is such a beautiful hand. It is so
curly
and so full of exuberant love, you know? You can just tell.
Yeah, you can feel it. And, you know, he had the most beautiful hands, too. Mm. I mean, physically, his hands were just like, and he would get teased by his friends would come in the house and they would say, yeah, you can tell you've been a lawyer all your life. Look at your hands. Your hands are like butter. You know, you haven't done a hard day's work. This is just what his father would say to
him. That's amazing.
Look at your hands. And I would say, leave his hands alone.
That's so beautiful. Yeah, I mean, it's also so interesting because, of course, in the public imagination, or what strangers would know about your dad is that, you know, he was this famous civil rights lawyer defending people for participating in these sit-ins and protests. And and then later, you know, the first African-American Chief Justice of South Carolina. So he was this really important figure in the public eye. But what was so incredible about your book is that none of that stuff is really in there. You know, it's really about your father as a father.
That is so important to me, Helena.
Yeah, and it was so, I don't know, I felt really privileged to get that look inside, you know, because of course, like a civil rights lawyer, like it's such an ugly history, right, that your father was tied to and that he had to witness.
Yep.
And so then to see, to just leave all of that behind for a little bit, right? Because I think there's so much focus in our culture on Black suffering.
Right.
But not on Black love.
Oh, you get it. I mean, that's just saying. It's like, Helena, this is just, you don't understand. You have no idea. We always talk about Black suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had all this love as a child in this world, even though every time we stepped out in it, it was a fight. And they taught me that too. But we never see Black people as carriers of love.
Mm-hmm.
We see them as carriers of pain. We see them carriers of forever, you know, 400 years of suffering.
Yeah, yes.
But not 400 years of fierce love.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want it to be like trying to erase the suffering or the pain that Black people walk through to the other side of. I'm not trying to say that. I am trying to say we never get the part in the movie that is the love child. We never get the part in the movie that says this person's life has been chiseled together, hammered together by love. Because for hundreds of years, Black people have been thought to be, you know, not human in the same way other people are human. So, I mean, how can you treat an enslaved person like an enslaved person was treated and think of them equally as human? You know what I mean? Like, I'm human, I'm a white person and I'm human, but I'm going to treat this person who is inhuman like this. Okay, I can get away with that because of how I see them. But if I see them as a loving human being trying to raise kids, I'm not going to separate those kids from the mother and the father, right? So I have to make up this lie. And so this book, for me, one of the reasons to not go into all the other things, even though at the beginning, it begins with the brutality, but it doesn't stay there. Mm-hmm. It goes to the other stories too, because I feel like that must be the body of this book, and that must be the end of this book, that love is the triumphant thing.
So I was wondering if you wanted to read one of these notes that your dad wrote you. And the first one in the book is at the end of the introduction, page 16. It's like the Roman numbers.
Yeah, let's see. So this one is so special to me because my father really believed in work. He believed in that. He's of that generation, born in 1931, born in Virginia, Smithfield, Virginia. But he was of farming people. And he used to tell me how he used to sit at the base of this oak tree and look up the road. The road was like 3 miles long. And all he wanted to do was go down that road and know what else was out in the world. But because he was a farming kid, he couldn't leave the farm.
Wow.
And so he had a work ethic like nobody's business. And so he was always imploring us, all of his children, to get up and go to work and to understand that your life should be filled with work and that work brought a sense of joy. It should have anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was always writing me about how's your work going? What are you working on? And, you know, before he said almost anything else. And so he sent me this post-it note. I remember I was in the middle of writing Rice and I was in the editing stage of it. And he knew I was working on it. And he just sent me a post-it note to just say, go to work, keep working, you know, you'll get it right. And then he flips it and says, I need you, you know, and I need you to be working and I need you at your fullest height in this world. And he was always in the sweetest, most compressed ways, always telling me that. So it just says, love child, go to work. I need you. Dad LaFox. And he had like four names that he always signed. Sometimes the letters have all the names. It's Papa, Dad, LaFox. Daddy was in South Carolina. There's this image of a Confederate politician who was called the Swamp Fox.
Mm.
And people called Daddy the Black Fox. Hmm. As kind of like counter image to that person. And he was so beloved by so many different people across the aisle. He could bring Black folks in one room, white folks in that same room, and he could make them, with his charm, talk to each other and figure things out. And I had never seen anybody do that before like he did it. And it was something that mattered to him because he really did want the state to not always be at the bottom of all the lists and always be ridiculed for not being more progressive and forward thinking.
Yeah.
And so it was very personal to him. South Carolina was being of South Carolina and also the many firsts that sort of followed him because he devoted himself to being a son of this state. But I knew that that wasn't what this book was about. He was just the best dad in the whole wide world. So I wanted that to be the focus when we were talking about the book.
Yeah. I love also that your dad clearly was not afraid of showing his feelings.
He was not. He was not. And he wrote them. You know, there's another... I was just reading it this morning, in fact. I don't know if you've seen this one. Where is it? I think it's on, page 184. And it's on the stationery of the Supreme Court of South Carolina. This is on my birthday in 1991. And he had not become the Chief Justice yet. But he says, my sweet, darling, precious daughter, since the day you were born, I have known that you were meant to be mine forever. No one has ever made me feel so complete, so happy, and as full of smiles as you do. You are with me wherever I am, and I know if you had not been born to us, I would still be looking for you. Love always, Dad, Pop, Zoop, LaFox.
I wanted to ask you about another moment that
sure
was really important in your life as a writer. So when you're 15, you and your family go and see a play by Lorraine Hansberry, who's most famous for her play A Raisin in the Sun. But that night, you went and saw To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, Lorraine Hansberry in her own words. And so you describe that by the time that you all got to the theater, that there was no more room for you and your family to sit together, and that you found yourself a spot on a windowsill. I can't quite see it. Like, how is there a windowsill in a theater? You know, can you describe what that looked like? And then also, I would love to know, since you were sitting by yourself, how did that influence how you saw the play? Like, what was that like to see the play that way?
This is such, you're such a good reader of moments that are so pivotal. I was 15. I did not want to go to this Broadway play in this tiny town, only because I did not realize how monumental it would become to me. We were not in a theater. We had no theater in this town. You had to find whatever building you could on this small black college campus to try to hold 200 or 300 people. The only building that would hold 200 or 300 people was the gymnasium.
Right.
And so they sort of retrofitted the gymnasium with a stage, not a great stage, but whatever they could pull together. They got the stage at the front. Uh-huh. They put these, folding chairs in. And so the windowsills were just like gym windows that you would like lean into and sit in. There was no screen. And I just threw the window up and sat in it. There's probably somebody else outside sort of leaning in at the same time, but I was by myself. And it did make a difference that I wasn't sitting beside my mother or beside my, family. It was a very, I could feel everything the words were saying to me in a very private way. I already was leaning into being a writer, but I did not know that a black woman could focus her life in this kind of way. So if I had not been alone, I don't know that I would have heard the words as intimately and as personally as I heard them. They were speaking to me. She was speaking, whoever was portraying her. I don't remember that, but those were words that were mine. And I remember not being able to get them out of my head for a long, long time. And of course you couldn't keep everything that was being said, but there was refrain lines like, I am a writer. I'm going to write, that I would just like say as I walked to school, I'm a writer. I am going to write. And she knew she was dying. She knew she wasn't going to be here. And so there's a paragraph where she's imploring the next generation or anybody within the sound of her voice to come and to finish the work that she started. I was like, I'm in that number. I mean, I could have been raising my hand in the gym, if I was too, afraid that people would look at me, but it hit me like a brick wall, what she was saying.
And do you remember when you found your family again at the end of it and then you had to go home, do you remember wanting to share that with them, or did you want to keep it private?
No. Private. Absolutely. It was now in the jewel box of my heart. It was not to be discussed yet, because I think at that point, 15 was such a pivotal age for me. I was really unfurling in some ways that would follow me to this moment. I was the only girl, and I was stepping away from the sort of training that you get as a Southern girl. I think I felt that, at least. I wanted to find out who I was. I wanted to find out what made my own heart. That's what Lorraine Hansberry talked about in that book, following her own path. And I had never heard a black woman speak about writing with such passion in such an intimate way. It just changed my life. And so I didn't want anybody else to discuss anything about it. I didn't want anybody to say it was good or bad.
No.
Because it was all perfect.
Yes.
So it was a very, very long time before I felt strong enough to share it with anybody or to have a conversation about it with anybody.
Right. There's this piece in your book, Inquisitor and Insurgent, Black Woman with Pencil Sharpened. And the excerpt that I was interested in is on page 28.
Sure. Okay. On our way home from the play, I asked my father what an insurgent was. It had been the word used in the play to describe Lorraine Hansberry. He looked at me. He looked away from me. He looked out of the window. I knew he knew what it meant. He didn't want to say. He didn't want me to know. Not yet. He could see how smitten I was by Hansberry's words. He wasn't ready to let me go, to go and become what the point of the pencil was pointing toward. This was the same man who had walked me to the pencil box instead of the candy store. The same man who never went on any road trip anywhere without returning with at least one book by a black writer. He sat them down near my pillow, and there they were when I awoke. This was the same man who bought his children tickets for off-Broadway plays that examined what it meant to be black in America. I was growing up fast and hanging off the new edges and old meanings of critically important words that America in general did not want me to become familiar with. The South I was growing up in was not changing very much, but other places were hot with change. I was his only daughter. He was afraid of the fear he could not find in my face, afraid of the light and the flame burning quietly there instead.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What do you think your dad didn't want you to know?
My dad knew how tenderhearted I was. I was really a tenderhearted child. I remember my mother calling me her sensitive child so many times, and it was not a good thing. Mm-hmm. When she said it, when my mother said it, it wasn't a good thing. My mother wanted me to be tough. I couldn't kill anything. I couldn't kill an ant. I couldn't kill a goldfish would die, and I would cry for a week, and she wanted me to just be tough. But my father would look at me in those moments, and he saw a strength in it where my mother saw a weakness. Mm-hmm. And they both knew the world they were preparing me for. They were just different people. My mom was tough. My mom is tough. And my grandmother, her mother, that matrilineal line, they don't tell you they love you. They show you they love you. But they don't say the word. It's too frilly and too something, you know?
Yeah.
But my father, as you can see from his letters, would tell you, I love you, and I love you this much.
Yeah.
And I would do anything for you. And it was really, he saw me in a moment of not being a child anymore, but looking for the right way to go. And he knew that his answer, because I trusted him so deeply, would propel me forward into some heartache, into more pain that awaited me beyond the sort of just regular pain of, you know, racism and the South in the 1970s and 60s. Yeah. That pain was already good there. So yeah. Then you're going to make it that much more difficult, Nikki Finney, by resisting and becoming even more an outlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just saw it happening because he knew me.
Yeah.
And so if he answered me about what an insurgent was, he knew I was going to follow it out. He knew that I was going to write it in my little journal book and I was going to maybe test the water. You know, and he was afraid for me.
Yeah, of course.
Like any parent who loved any child would be. They want you to be protected. They don't want to, you know, they don't want you to like have to fall down and get up. But he knew I had to fall down and get up too. He knew that.
That's so beautiful. And it's a question that I've been mulling over as I was reading your book. I want to know how a sensitive child like you, with such hair trigger perception, I wonder what that process was like for you through your writing to engage with the most cruel things that human beings do to one another while being the sensitive person that you are.
Yes, this is one of the best questions I've ever been asked. Hmm. And it's also one of the ones that continues to, in a way, elude me, because it's such a natural, like, I can't tell you what I've done to continue to put my hands around the bloodiness of life at the same time that I put my hand around the beauty of life. Mm-hmm. I only know that when I was a very novice poet, just starting out, not knowing how to do this, I knew that I had to stay connected to my sensitive child. I knew that if I lost sight of her, and this is what my father fought for, if I lost sight of her in the fog of growing up, then I would lose my sense of self. I grew up in the 60s and 70s when a lot of people were screaming necessary things. I don't want to sound like I disassociated myself from the screamers. I did not. I listened. Mm-hmm. And I began to tell myself, I don't want to scream this at the world. I want to sit in the sensitive child's chair, and I want to bring forth what I bring forth from that vantage point. I always felt like, because my father rode me around in that car, because I had somebody who championed my interior space.
Yeah.
That this was not to be forgotten.
Right, right. That's so interesting. Because I feel like so many people who are sensitive, when they then are drawn to do something or say something about the injustice that they see in the world, often I feel like that pain turns inward and becomes destructive, you know, turns into depression, turns into self-harm, you know, something like that.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, are there specific ways in which you have been taught by people you met along the way, or that you've learned just by trial and error, to keep yourself in a place where the pain doesn't have to destroy you?
I feel like two things save me every day of my life. Every day I open my eyes, every day I sit to write something, there are two giant things that walk into the room before I can do my work. One comes out of the sensitive child who hopefully has grown up into the sensitive woman, and that is, I have always felt an incredible empathy for other living things. And that goes back to that story I told you about not being able to kill anything and seeing myself and human beings or animal or insect. I have just always had a huge empathetic muscle. Mm-hmm. The second thing that was the gift to me from the time I was born and raised in this world had to be the empowering movements, Black Power movements, women's movements, gay rights movements, all those movements mm-hmm. were like pushing into the air when I was 15 and 16 and 17. And so I saw people reaching for a kind of new strength in the sort of modern moment, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Black Arts Movement and the Black Power Movement made me reach for the history of being Black in America, which stretched back to being African.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, and I say this to myself to this day, when I have a hard day, when something tough happens, I said, do you know what your people went through? Do you know what slavery, to be enslaved, must have been like? I mean, I keep jumping because you keep asking such great questions, but that my speech at the National Book Award, this speech, I have gotten letters from Greece, from Iran, from India, people who have heard this speech, who have just wanted to thank me for what I said. And I'm like, what did I say? I mean, I thanked my ancestors, but that didn't seem so big to me. That was something that I had done my entire life. I asked for help from them. I asked for permission. I never forget them. I would not be here if they had not sacrificed their lives and held on and lived through, you know, beatings and whippings and not being able to read and write and no poetry.
Yeah.
And to be in the back of a car with a father who would, you know, say, what do you see, baby? Love child, tell me what you see. And so I always think about the strength of my ancestors. And then I can feel my whole body just like exhale. I'm like, this is nothing.
Yeah.
And so my self-regard, mm-hmm. Helena, is strong because I know my history and because my history is connected to that 400-year-old history in America and to the history before America in Africa, where we were kings and queens and mathematicians and artisans, you know, before. So I don't start with slavery as my beginning. You have to look at what people don't want you to know.
Right.
Yes, you have to go study that because it's very empowering. And it's, they can't have you. You know, they can't own me. They can't have me. I can work for people and I can have a job at a school. But mm-hmm. when you know who you are, you know, it's like, it's, there's nothing like that.
I wanted to get to one last poem. It's one of the hotbeds, number 77, which is on page 153.
Okay. Yep. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Yes. This is with my dear, dear friend, Claire, Hotbed 77. And, you know, I went to the Brooklyn Museum to see the Lorraine Hansberry show. I bought an airline ticket and I went up for 3 days and I only went to the exhibit and came home. And mm-hmm. so this is one of the moments that I wrote in my journal book once I got back from that. Hotbed 77. Claire calls. I don't even wait to say hello. I launch into what I have just discovered. Two of Lorraine Hansberry's pallbearers were her former lovers. From 600 miles away, I can hear her almost drop the phone. What did you say? I say it again. She makes me say it twice more. We sit there holding the phone, saying nothing, thinking about the power of this scene in 1965. The power of one woman loving another woman is power enough. Add the power of two different lovers from two different moments in her life, standing up together at the end of her life, when it was such a great taboo to love another woman in order to take her body on up the road as far as they could. The phone is quiet for a long while. Then Claire asks me, "Do you think Lorraine Hansberry left instructions for this?" "I don't know." "Do you think there is a photo of all three of them?" "I don't know." Suddenly, there is a thick, milky silence between us that neither wishes to break. We want to hold ourselves in the thickness of the thought. I know without asking that we are both wondering, who will stand and pallbear us? Who will carry us to the end?
Nikki Finney is the author of 6 poetry collections: Love Child's Hotbed of Occasional Poetry, The World is Round, Heartwood, Rice, On Wings Made of Gauze, and Head Off and Split, which won the National Book Award, and where she gave that speech thanking her ancestors, which the host of the National Book Award called the best acceptance speech ever for anything. She won a PEN America Open Book Award and the Benjamin Franklin Award for Poetry. She's a founding member of the Afro-Latian Poets, a group of Appalachian poets of color. She's on faculty at Caveh Kanem, and after 23 years as a professor at the University of Kentucky, she now teaches at the University of South Carolina. To find out more about her work, check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos, and the sounds of backyards in South Carolina are from freesound.org. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.